Morning, everyone. Welcome to Grand Rounds. This morning, it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Stefan Pasternak. Dr. Pasternak is a board-certified psychiatrist and psychoanalyst and a distinguished life fellow of the American Psychiatric Association. He graduated from Georgetown University School of Medicine and did his internship at UCLA and his psychiatry residency at the University of Cincinnati. He currently is an affiliate professor at the Charles E. Schmidt College of Medicine, and he also teaches, he's a teaching analyst at the Florida Psychoanalytic Center. This morning he's going to talk about a very important topic that all of us have to deal with, is stress in the medical practice, avoiding risks and burnout and suicide. As many of you know, that stress management is a big part of the push of ACP right now and a lot of the medical organizations. So it's my pleasure to welcome him.
Thank you. Nice to be here and appreciate your coming. I've been doing this for 50 years now, and I am a bit taken aback in the last 5 or 10 years to see how much more difficult life has become for practicing physicians. I used to see doctors who would be troubled by a difficult case or an adverse result or someone who was depressed. But now it seems to me that the transition from being in the practice of medicine to having a position in the healthcare industry has taken away so much of the autonomy, creativity, and freedom, and the sense of power over what they do that undercuts the doctor's self-esteem. So we're going to look into some of this. Today I want to talk with you about sources of stress in practice. I also want to emphasize the various basic biological mechanisms that can sneak up on you and that then will trigger psychological reactions. And then we're going to talk about, once we understand etiology, we're going to talk about prevention and resilience and preventing becoming so disheartened that you would think of suicide and when to seek professional help. Now, the spectrum of stress covers a broad area, and we shouldn't trivialize it. Yes, it is stressful to be stuck in traffic on I-95 when you've got to get to the ER or you've got a patient in your office, and all these little pinpricks of life are the mild aggravation things that can accumulate. Major illnesses and death and serious disappointments, a malpractice suit, for example, can also become very, very stressful. And then we have the unusual and acute traumatic and post-traumatic stress events such as 9/11, a plane crash, maybe a train crash, a terrorism incident, which are all too frequent. Now, handling good stress, I think, is like surfing. We love what we do when we are able to do it the way we want to do it. It's exciting, we're challenged, we do research, we work hard, and you pick the right wave and you're prepared, and a good medical career is the ride of a life. On the other hand, the toxic aspects of practice are a wipeout. So these threats to autonomy and creativity brought about by the shift from the practice of medicine to the healthcare industry are part of what undercut this. And we're going to look at a lot of specific risk factors. Demographically, I was astonished to learn that now suicide after automobile and other types of accidents is actually the most frequent cause of death among medical students. That's staggering. You might think it would be pneumonia or some other ailment. 25% of graduating students report clinical depression, and that's not from any one particular medical school. That was an article in JAMA about a national survey. Residents at the University of Florida, 31% screened positive for depression, and 50% of 7,000 physicians that were studied and a study in the Archives of Internal Medicine reported at least one symptom of burnout, and we lose over 400 physicians a year to suicide. What are some of the top factors, and what can you notice so that you become aware? Because So much of what you have to start to do in medical school is to have a heightened awareness. Now, that runs contrary to what we often expect of ourselves as we dissect cadavers, as we examine bodies. We learn to suppress repulsive feelings or disgust or just shock when we see some terribly injured or burned person. So we learn to bury feelings, but you all, on the other hand, have to be able to process and metabolize through what we call mindfulness exercises. And the more you can do that, the more you can decompress each day. Among the top stressors externally are bureaucratic tasks, getting prior authorizations, too many hours at work, and not enough personal time. Feeling like an assembly line worker, being forced to, you know, produce, and churn through the patients. Of course, the EHR came out centuries before it was really ready and has driven almost everybody nuts with various versions that are incompatible, and practices have invested thousands of dollars and now have to start over because their EHR company went out of business. It has really driven people up the wall. And then, of course, there's been cutbacks in income, lower payments, and reimbursements are a challenge to private practices in particular. And students, we now know, are coming out with $200,000 to $300,000 in educational debt, which means they've got a lot of interest to pay off, and you know, and this huge burden. Now, who are the highest burnout rates? Well, emergency medicine, because the constant death, disaster, horrible wounds. You know, it's exciting on television, it's exciting in the ER, but we all know after a couple of weeks on ER rotation, you're kind of shocked by the tragedies and the cruelties of life. OBGYN, family medicine, and internal medicine also report higher burnout rates, the lowest being dermatology, ophthalmology, psychiatry, allergy, and pathology. But a key factor in all medical fields is that doctors are working at least on average 10 hours more than almost anybody else in our society, and that's a lot of extra work. Now, I bring up malpractice suits because it's an example of how an external event gets inside of you, and that's a phenomenon that we need to talk about. First, was what I call a psychoendocrine events. That is, when you get a subpoena, you're going to have a cascade of stress hormones that's going to affect the way your mind, the software, will work. And physicians who are prone to keeping feelings to themselves often nurture private feelings of shame about a lawsuit. So the external event starts to eat away at their sense of self-confidence. Now, one thing physicians often forget, while you can't discuss the details of your case with other people because that's discoverable by the opposing attorney, you can discuss your feelings about what's going on, and certainly with your spouse. Now, lawsuits trigger shame, which is one of the most toxic emotions. Do any of you remember Admiral Border? During the Clinton administration, he was the chief of Navy operations. And Time magazine accused him of wearing a tiny piece of tin on one of the 30 medals he got for combat in Vietnam. And this was a piece of tin that you get for extra heroism or something. And he was so shamed by the national attention focused on him that he blew his brains out at work. So shame is one of those things, and you see it particularly among college students and adolescents. They do poorly on their SATs, their girlfriend breaks up with them, and pow. So watch out for shame. Oops. Okay. So what we're talking about is how external stress triggers internal conflict, and these events undermine your ability to adapt in a constructive fashion. It undermines your tolerance for frustration and fosters negative thinking and will make you angry, irritable, sullen, pouty, what have you. So we're trying to look at the interaction between external stresses, how hard you have to work, the burdens you have with your family and your practice, and internal reactions to that, which have to do with what you expect of yourself. Now, we all want to make a good living, but if you decide you want to corner the market and be the most referred to doctor in your specialty, and you're willing to work God number of hours, greed can drive you crazy and exhaust you. And we've seen that in some famous cases of doctors who've made hundreds of millions of dollars in Medicare fraud, and you wonder, what were they thinking? So you have to watch your own internal emotional struggles and impulses so you regulate them to keep you out of trouble. Lust, we certainly see plenty of sexual acting out. The best thing is to remember, once a patient, always a patient, and try to avoid dating patients or your staff, because that leads to problems. And we'll talk a little bit later about the sexual harassment that women physicians are subject to, and not just the sexual harassment, but the emotional pinpricks of not being recognized the same as men are. Shame, making a mistake. When you make a mistake, we're all going to do that. I made one this week, and it started to bug me. And I had to say, I could only think about this for 2 minutes, because more than 2 minutes of worrying wasn't going to deal with it. But I had to realize I have an eraser. I can fix things, or I can talk to the patient about the error I made. But we all have to live with it. And almost every one of us has a patient during our training years who we feel we might have contributed to their death. I know I had one patient when I was a junior, my first few days in the emergency room, and I was assigned to look after a patient way over my level of experience. I never should have been told to monitor this case. And the patient died, and I irrationally blamed myself for that. And it was one of those turning points in my career when I had to say, well, suck it up, you got to get on with it. And fortunately, my friends and I were able to discuss this, and it helped me. And later on, when I was doing my personal analysis, it was an issue that came up and that I found was surprised to find that it still troubled me. So we can have a persistent sense of guilt. And of course, cheating, you know, it doesn't pay to cheat on exams, because then you don't know what you know, but falsifying records really can get a doctor into trouble. So those are some of the internal temptations you have in the course of a busy day that you have to wrestle with. What makes us great also hurts us. We are great in our devotion to patients. We go the extra mile. We pay attention to detail. We stay as late at the office as it takes to get the job done. And we try to live up to the Hippocratic ideal. That sets us up for a lot of extremely high expectations. And so our personality become a risk factor. And there's sort of what we might identify among physicians as the compulsive triad. First, none of us got here by being lazy or ignoring detail. Our society highly rewards obsessive-compulsive behavior because it's complicated stuff. You have to know what you're doing, you have to practice it, you have to pay attention to detail. So that means every doctor, most of us, walk around worried about, did we miss something, did we forget something? And the doubt leads to some guilt and an exaggerated sense of responsibility. And the fear of making a mistake leads to pursuit of perfectionism. And perfectionism means you don't have compassion for yourself. If you make a mistake, you're going to beat yourself up, and instead of trying to face the mistake and fix whatever consequences are, you don't want to wallow in self-blame and shame. And then, of course, we all find ourselves being rushed and sometimes not having enough time with the patient, so that fosters a sense of guilt. And the exaggerated sense of responsibility can easily lead to overwork. Now, Freud coined some terms that I think are still valid, and one of them is the superego. you could call it conscience. It's just the we all walk around with a sense of morality about what we think is right, and that's very high in physicians, and it leaves us vulnerable to what I call moral stress. I'll come to that in just a minute. The other danger for physicians is what I mentioned. When we sit down with that cadaver, you immediately have to deny a lot of feelings that you have about it. And when we're operating in the operating room, we have a little field so we can try to forget that we're actually inside another person's body, because these are disturbing images. So suppressing and denying emotion is encouraged. But this leads you to have fear that if you tell anybody you're anxious or upset about something, it will be held against you. And then many state medical boards make the mistake of insisting that doctors report any therapy or any psychotropic medications they may take, so it makes it doctors afraid that they might not get their license renewed, or they might be forced to go through some independent examination just because they had 6 months of Prozac because they had an episode of depression after they had an adverse event in their life. So we have to be able to accept our emotional needs and not let the culture of silence drag us down. And so we come to the Hippocratic Oath, which is the ego ideal, what we all desire to be. Man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? But how do we feel when we reach and we can't quite get as far as we want? Well, if you reach for the stars but you get the moon, I say you're doing okay. And anybody who becomes a physician has achieved an ideal accomplishment. None of us are going to be perfect. So if you expect perfection, you're setting yourself up for an internal conflict that leads to shame and guilt and mental exhaustion, because you have to devote emotional resources to keep the lid on all these feelings that are bottling up. Now, modern medicine then went ahead and played a trick on us in the sense that reasoning based on cost is something we all resist. If we feel a patient needs an MRI, we want to be able to get the MRI, not have to worry about who's paying for it. And so this opens us up to moral stress, and many physicians, I know I've done it, lied at times to get a patient a drug or a test that I thought they needed, and usually I was right. But, you know, you don't feel good about a white lie on an insurance form or something, even though it's in the interest of the patient. It sets you up possibly for an ethics violation. So the struggle, again, the external stress becomes internalized. Now, the question is, can we objectively measure stress? And yes, we can. And no measurement is perfect, but I'm going to suggest one that you've probably seen around, heard of, but it's still valid. This is the Holmes-Rahe Life Stress Scale. This comes out of research done in the Navy on aircraft carriers when they were trying to figure out why young men fell ill and some of the young men did not. Who were the guys who are constantly at sick bay? Now, you can get this online. And it's useful. One of the reasons I ended up in Florida was because in 2004, we had the deaths of four family members, including my brother-in-law, who was a young doctor, just 59. And it so hammered me that I knew I was on the injured list. And I knew I needed some time off. And it was an appropriate time for me to restructure my life. So I took a year off, and that gave me a chance to work my way through what I had to work my way through. But this scale has validity, and if you're 150 score, you can easily cope with it. You get up to 200 to 250%, and you start to have a greater risk of a physical illness or an accident or a mental illness. And if you have over 300 points in a 6 month period of time, you're really heading to trouble. Now, so I keep this scale on my refrigerator, and it enables me to keep track of what's going on in my life. And I went did a study with some friends of mine in their practices in Washington to get them to have their patients fill it out. And they began to find that, yes, if the patient came in and had all these events, usually, you know, you ask a patient anything going on in your life, a lot of patients are going to say, no, I'm fine. Well, they're not fine. Their daughter just, you know, had a car accident. Their mother-in-law has cancer. Their business isn't doing as well. And a lot of people don't want to tell the doctor. They just complain about a headache or a backache. But if you monitor these events, it will help you know more about your patients and yourself. So if we distill this out and we try to say, what are the equivalents from life to practice? The loss of loved ones or of relationships, which is the highest source of stress, relates to the death of long-term patients. I've had many colleagues in their 60s just couldn't bear to see another patient they've had for 20, 30 years with cancer or a stroke. It begins to chisel away at you. And marital relationships or love relationships are both the most important refuge and shelter from stress, place to get comfort, can become a source of tension, and now you feel married to a career which is cheating on you. Our careers are cheating on us, and I'll explain that in a little bit with another research story. Disruptions at work, threats of illness or injury are similar to threats of lawsuits. Many of us feel impotent at work when we're not able to do the evaluations we need to do, and you're just rushing people through. And so the Holmes-Rahe stress scale can be of use to you in keeping track of what's going on. Now, external events hit the cerebral cortex, trigger stress hormones release, so we're constantly looking at how neural networks and neurotransmitters are responding. And here is where there are biological differences. If you have a lot of the serotonin transporter gene, you are somewhat more buffered against reactions to external stresses. And all this new genetic research goes on to explain host responsiveness. Why does a tuberculosis bacillus make one person sick and not the other? Host responsiveness. And so you need to look at your own psychoendocrine reactions. I have a couple of very difficult patients, and they threaten suicide. And so I was teasing with one of them the other day. I said, I took my blood pressure before you come in. I'm going to take my blood pressure after you leave. And if it's gone up, you get a 10% surcharge because you're burning me up. You know, and so that's what I encourage you to keep track of. How is your mind and body responding to things? Does your back hurt? Do your sinuses inflame? You know what I mean. And here is some of the science. It's the cortex versus the amygdala. The amygdala is our ancient fear center, and it gets rattled and shoots off signals. Red alert, red alert. And if your cortex can't tone it down, you may respond with hyperarousal, hypervigilance, overreact to a small event. And this is more likely to happen at the end of the day when your ego strengths and tolerance for frustration have already been withered away. So neural networks and transmitters are constantly interacting with the software of your mind. They are inseparable. And it's like external stress playing on the piano keys of your psyche. Now, we know that stress hormones trigger inflammatory reactions, and when you get a fire in your body, that's very serious stuff, and then we feel ill physically, makes dealing with things emotionally more difficult. Now, recently, they've been doing MRIs, and guys coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and we find that the amygdala shrinks and the hippocampus will shrink under chronic stress. And now they've been doing those studies on stressed executives. And so just at a time, like you have a malpractice suit and your practice is going through a tough time, your office manager quit, your daughter-in-law is doing this, your mother-in-law that, it hammers your hippocampus and amygdala. So when you need to make the clearest decisions and be the most accurate, you're less likely to be able to do so, which is why if your stress is building up, you may need to make sure you are getting someone to cross-check a lot of your decisions, running things by somebody. Is this a good time for me to call the patient up and yell at them for suing me? I don't think so. Never a good time to do that. But in your anger and your heat and your sense of betrayal, you do all sorts of things you'll regret. Now, just to show how government can screw things up for us too, at the Kennedy Space Center in the 70s, they recorded the highest incidence of sudden death among healthy young engineers. These guys were building the most complicated pieces of equipment mankind had ever built. And they were in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. They were jogging on the beach up at what was then Cape Canaveral. And so many of them were dying that the CIA thought the Russians were poisoning them somehow to sabotage our program. And a very talented guy by the name of Robert Elliott, who was the director of the Cardiac Stress Lab at the University of Nebraska at the time, was commissioned to come down and study the problem. Now, I was very interested in his research because one day in a conference, I was interviewing a woman, and all of a sudden, in the middle of the conference, we had a visiting analyst, I had to present a case. The woman stood up and screamed, "Oh my God, he's having an affair." And in that moment, in front of a group of strangers, she realized the reason her husband wasn't coming home at night. And she ran screaming out of the conference room and dropped dead. She was 32, had two children. And I was like, I made a mistake going into psychiatry, because if you talk to someone and that could kill them, how the hell did that happen? So that put me on the trail of what causes sudden cardiac death. And then this research started to come out. So what they showed was that these poor engineers were caught in a double bind. Congress, in its infinite wisdom, approved funding for 13 rockets. 13 crews were hired. So when your rocket launched, you were out of a job. What happened if your rocket didn't launch? Shame, mortification, watching your rocket blow up. So these guys were caught in a toxic double bind where nothing they couldn't win. And in the aerospace industry at that time, there was a downturn, so they couldn't easily leave NASA and get other jobs. Well, what does that do to somebody? Well, forced helplessness is toxic. And being in a lose-lose situation, you get toxic releases of adrenaline, and Robert Elliott's work showed that you could get huge arrhythmias and even myocardial rupture, which was happening with some of these young engineers. Now, we know stress-induced myocardial ischemia can certainly produce an infarct, so it's no stretch to know that other toxic events can cause disaster. So how do you buffer yourself against this? Well, if you were one of those young engineers, the chances are you would start interviewing for other jobs, or you might try to patent something. You would have to try to find a way to avoid forced helplessness. And that's what doctors are forced to now, because so often we feel betrayed. We signed up, we have a lot of educational debt, we're working very hard. Now they're going to cut your pay. Now they're going to force you to see more patients. It begins to feel like double jeopardy. So what can you control? The computer bosses you around, managed care bosses you around, MIPS, FIPS, CHIPS, whatever. All these things drive you nuts. So the only thing you can really control is yourself. And that is a take-home point from this talk. You have to take care of yourself, psychologically and physically. So what are personality styles that can help you resist the kinds of stresses on the Holmes-Rahe scale? Can you change your personality? I have had patients who are had three or four heart attacks and had three or four stents. Guys like Dick Cheney in Washington, and they would come for help. If I don't change, I'm going to die. And I got to tone it down. I'm a type A. I have to win all the time. And so can a person change their personality? Well, yes, they can. You try to avoid doomsday thinking. Just because Obamacare was put in place, it doesn't mean the end of democracy. If Obamacare is undermined, it's not going to be the end of healthcare. There are problems, and the key thing is to break them down into bite-sized pieces about which you can do something. So you can't change what Medicare is going to do next year, but can you organize your office staff efficiently? Can you improve your billing practices? What can you do for that? And then when something goes wrong, tendency is to pin it on somebody. And accountability is important, but you don't want to spend so much time fixing blame that you don't constructively deal with the problem. What's the most important thing is to solve the problem. There's time for blame someone else later on. And then you have to seek help when you're not sure what to do, hire your consultants, delegate tasks, and above all, foster a sense of humor and altruism, because that will relax everybody around you. One of the best examples of this was Ronald Reagan. He was shot. He was in the emergency room at George Washington University Hospital. The surgeon came in with his staff, and Ronald Reagan looked up at them and said, "I hope you're Republicans." And everybody lightened up, because he set them at ease and trusted them, and it worked out. So, you know, you try to have holiday parties for your office staff, you try to lighten up, you try to give people recognition. Perfectionism, the Osler ideal of equanimity, is unrealistic. You know, yes, we don't want to fly off the handle at our patients, but you have to be able to talk about the impact that patients have on you without revealing names. So on occasion, if I've had a difficult day, for many years in Washington, especially after 9/11, it was exhausting because there were so many people who had government jobs. Some guys were coming in carrying gas masks. Other people were carrying anthrax injectors. One guy said to me, "Don't go downtown tomorrow." I said, "Why not?" He said, "I can't tell you." I said, "Well, can I tell my wife?" "No." So you get these sources of stress. I go home, my wife says, "You look upset about something." I said, "Don't go downtown tomorrow." "I can't tell you why." So, you know, it gets under your skin, external stress. You have to have capacities to put it in perspective, avoid shame, have realistic expectations of yourself. Now, the number one problem for doctors is denial. I like to ask this question: what's the number one cause of death in the United States? And you're likely to say heart attack, strokes, or cancer. And I'm going to say you're wrong. It's a mental problem, denial. Because if you have a rectal bleed and you ignore it, you're going to die. If you have a lump in your breast and you ignore it, if you're having unsafe sex, smoking, drinking, driving recklessly, not getting annual checkups, not eating properly, smoking. So denial is a problem. And most physicians know what they should do, so why don't they do it for themselves? That's the dilemma. They're less likely to obtain care than the general population. 35% have no doctor of their own. Many self-prescriber use samples. They don't have anyone to talk to, and they become lonely. Now, suicide among physicians is a serious national problem. It's twice as high as the general public. Very few doctors seek mental health care before they attempt suicide, 300 to 400 a year. Every case is unique, and there are a lot of complicated psychodynamics, but shame is one of the most common features. I did something wrong, I deserve to die. Now, When I first had a patient who was a suicidal physician, it was a guy I knew in the hospital, and I had stopped in the physician's lounge on my way home to make a phone call, and a fellow comes in and he says, "Can I talk to you for a minute?" I said, "Yeah." He tells me that he had miscalculated the dose of an experimental drug, and the patient he was treating for some disease died. He said, "I have a gun in my car, a syringe of morphine on my desk. What do I do?" I took him by the hand. I said, "You come with me." And we walked up to the inpatient unit, and I said, "You're staying here till we get this sorted out." And he didn't fight me on that, and we saved a life. But, you know, how is it possible that we fight so hard to save other lives, and yet we can be willing to throw our own away? And that's because your mind runs away with you. Oh, the patient's going to sue me. I'm going to be humiliated. No one will want to see me anymore. My friends will turn their backs on me. My wife or husband won't admire me anymore. And this doomsday thinking is like an infection, like a staph infection of the mind. And it ramps up. And so we have to try to get someone to get some help before it goes too far. Now, suicidal ideation is like an infection. Long before a person is consciously aware of it, they have unconscious signs of it. So before you have septicemia, you're likely to have a fever. You're likely to have pain somewhere. And in terms of suicidal infection, you have nightmares, bizarre psychosomatic symptoms, mood changes, behavioral changes. And there are some warning signs. If someone sells their favorite collection of pens or artwork or whatever they're collecting, someone needs to make a new will, someone begins to withdraw. Vince Foster, again in the Clinton administration, there were many signs that he was suicidal. He had withdrawn socially. He's sitting in his house with darkened shades. He got his family practitioner to mail him antidepressants, but he wasn't being monitored while taking them. And they empowered him enough to have enough energy to shoot himself. So it creeps up on you. And then at some point when the person is planning to act, they are aware of it. One day, a young man came to visit his girlfriend on the ward. She had attempted suicide because he had broken up with her. He felt guilty about it. He made up with her. She was doing well. He left the psychiatric inpatient unit and jumped off the Calvert Street Bridge. Half an hour later. And I saw this guy talking to the girlfriend. And I'm thinking to myself, how is it possible that he had this in his mind? There were a million people around. All he had to do was say, "Help." And yet, that's what it can do to you. Now, if you suspect someone is harboring suicidal ideation, don't be afraid to ask them about it. Rather than provoke a suicide, you're going to start what would be a life-saving conversation. And when people finally say something about it, now you're able to do something about it, and now a relationship can help. So when you have patients in your office and they start asking for too many refills or increasing doses of sleeping pills, your index of suspicion should go up, especially these days with what's going on with opiates. Now, female physicians have it even harder. Because they are still in the minority in medicine, although coming to be more 50% of medical student classes, they are expected to make more sacrifices, more compromises. They experience more guilt when they have to leave their children home than their doctor-physician husband will when he leaves. And they have longings to be with their children. And how do you strike a happy balance? The other problem is that there's a lot of sexual harassment of women. We did a study 1 year and found that 25% of the medical students felt they had been sexually harassed by faculty. It happened a lot in surgical suites when they were in scrubs, someone brushing up against them or peeking in on them, lewd comments being made, weird jokes, offers to have drinks at the end of the day, groping. So we have sexual education, which has been very good in a lot of respects, but it's been disconnected from relationship education, and I think it's got people so revved up on the gymnastics of sex that they forget people are involved. And I was telling Dr. Zanzos that my wife, when she was a graduate student, was hit on by her professor, who was the chair of her graduate committee. She was pregnant with our second kid at the time. I wanted to go kill the guy. And so I became very much aware that this is a real issue. And then when I would go to professional meetings with my wife, they treated me as if I was the accountant and she was my spouse, whereas it was the other way around. So women get needled. You can't be the doctor. You know, you're just a woman, right? And so there's this putting down and insult to basic self-esteem. So we all have to be cautious about that. And, you know, we do need a national movement, and it's a good thing. Have any of you seen Time magazine this week with Ashley Judd and all the brave women who were celebrated for their courage in coming out? Well, no woman should be subjected to sexual harassment, certainly not medical students, interns or residents, or practicing physicians. Now, from a systems point of view, burnout is an organizational issue. Hospitals have to have realistic policies, realistic schedules. Some of the complaints I've heard from physician patients in the last few years, I come to work, they moved my office, they didn't even tell me about it. I came to work, they're cutting my pay because of this formula or that formula. I worked for 40 years building this program, I got an email, they were replacing me. No one even told me this was coming. You have to have respect for the years of service. We can't treat doctors who are, even if they're employees, in a dehumanizing fashion. Now, I get really worked up about this battle, medicine versus bureaucracy. We're trying to improve the provision of care and take into account cost factors. This puts a heavy burden on us to make a balanced decision. But how the hell do you figure the fact that this guy who's the CEO of Aetna, who's organizing a merger with CVS, is going to receive a $500 million payoff if this merger takes place? What in the world did this man do in 10 years of CEO that justifies $500 million, which is, by the way, coming out of the company's pockets, one way or the other? $500 million could pay for a lot of physical exams, a lot of vaccinations, a lot of MRIs. So those are the kind of things that drive me crazy. And the other thing that drives me crazy, although it doesn't affect me, are the maintenances of certifications. And I know how harassed physicians feel about that. But there are things you can do. You can write your boards. You can write your legislatures. Anti-MOC legislation has been approved in a number of states. Part of a suicide note was this. Today, I finally realized how little I mean to people. Nothing will change when I'm no longer here. You'll carry on and act like I never meant a thing. That's what some of these dehumanizing experiences do. They grind you down. Your office has changed. You have to pay extra money for courses you don't need. Your compensation may be changed. Your computer is driving you nuts. Every person needs to feel valued, to be recognized for their contribution, to have others listen to them and take them seriously, and to feel that you're recognized and you're in the loop and you're consulted on things. So there are a lot of things you can't control. So you have to monitor yourself, do your stress scale, metabolize your thoughts and feelings each day so that you are aware of what's going on inside of you. Now, burnout is a very complicated phenomena, complicated result of stress, disrupting your neuropsychoimmuno functions. You have exhaustion. You have depersonalization. There may be disruptive behavior. A surgeon throws a knife at the anesthesiologist. Not good. You know, I've seen that happen. Verbal abuse of others. Screaming at patients, screaming at doctors or nurses in the hallway. Irritability, sleep problems. These are when doctors may become overly sexually harassing. They're feeling harassed, so they start hitting on other people. And you get various forms of impairment. So if you monitor your stress, you pay attention to warning signs, you can take care of yourself and prevent the toxic state of constant fight-flight mode with toxic hormones raging. You can foster resilience with a balanced life, enough time for family and recreation. I mentioned already denial. If you know what you need to do and you don't do it, time for a consultation. You should be exercising. You should be eating a healthy way. You should be having time for a movie and some fun. When should you get help? Well, if you're feeling depressed and anxious and it's interfering with your function, for sure. You hate going to work and you're avoiding people, that's a warning sign. You're acting in a disruptive manner or having tensions, that's a warning sign. And if your spouse or partner, significant other, says you need help, chances are you should listen to them. And certainly if you're starting to self-medicate. Now, there's a lot of treatments. I don't have time to go into all of them today. But if you take care of yourself, you can avoid the worst of it. The first thing I do every year is plan my vacations. Then work falls in around that. Then I know I'm going to have a chance to renew myself. I try to modify my workload. And I certainly try to share with colleagues things that are getting under my skin so we can avoid them becoming overwhelming. Now, because of this problem, the Palm Beach County Medical Society has started a program called the Physician Wellness Program. Any medical student, resident, can easily become a member of the society at a very low cost. I think for medical students, it's free. We will provide 6 free counseling sessions along what's called an employee assistance model. And we have licensed PhDs and experienced clinical social workers. There's a private health line. You call that number, identify yourself as a medical society member seeking help through the Physician's Wellness Program, and you can choose a person who is on our website who signed up to be a therapist and have 6 sessions. If you want to continue with that person, you work out a fee arrangement with them, but the medical society will pay for 6 sessions for you. And so that gives you a chance. It's confidential. The medical society won't know who you are. You'll be assigned a number by the call for health private health line. And the therapist will not be reporting to anybody. We're trying to do this to get people before they become impaired. Once you become impaired with substance abuse or abnormal behavior, you get reported to the physician's referral network, and now you're monitored by the state. We're trying to prevent that by seeing you ahead of time. Okay, so that's it. I could talk all day about this. I hope this has given you some ideas about this problem, and I'll be here if you have any questions. I have a comprehensive reading list which I can give you, and there's a new book that just came out, Physician Mental Health and Well-Being, by Bauer and Reba, that is very useful. Any questions? Thank you for your time.